You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1979 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Peake on the subject, True Principles in an Unprincipled World.
Possibly an alternative title for this series of discussions might be Belaboring the Obvious. Because some of these principles that we have drawn up here should certainly be obvious to anyone. However, there is something to be said for belaboring the obvious, and that is when we stumble or make a mistake, it's usually because we ignore something that's obvious, is it not? It's in the simple things that we go astray and fail. Possibly there's, of course, we all have a certain amount of absent-mindedness. Ex-professor is an excess and amount of it. Sometimes when we are in a situation where we know we are in real danger, we may take very considerable care. At other times when we feel confident and no need for being extremely careful, then is when we often stumble and make sometimes even a fatal blunder. Now, I didn't mention it yesterday, which I might have, but there is a book in the Christadelphian literature. I see a copy over there on the table. One of the finest books that the Christadelphians have, by Brother Islip Collier, and its title is Principles and Proverbs. Some of you I know are familiar with it, and undoubtedly many of you possess the book. It's a book that one can well afford to read every now and then, repeatedly. For one thing, not only was Brother Collier a very intelligent and very logical person. He was also a very mild person and one who could state things with extreme clarity. So if you're in the market for a good book that is both theologically sound and psychologically practical, I highly recommend Principles and Proverbs. Now, last time we more or less covered what we have under the first two headings of this outline. And if there are any who have come in today who do not possess one, Brother Charles has them at hand and can he'll even deliver one personally to you. Now, these things that we have called principles that are listed here in our outline are conclusions, you might say, that we can derive from facts. And we said yesterday that all true spiritual principles, in fact, all true natural principles, including the laws of nature, derive from the fact of God's existence. He is the creator of all things. He set in motion this universe of which we are a tiny part, and instituted the laws which we find observed in nature. All you have to do is to read from the first chapter of Genesis as to how God made certain laws for things natural. For example, it is a law that like produces like, and that the seed of every living thing is in it. And this is true of both plants and animals. But we are concerned, of course, primarily with the spiritual and moral laws that God has instituted. And we want to consider these in a pragmatic way, so that we can make use of them in the leading of our day-to-day lives. So, to repeat, if it seems as though we are belaboring the obvious here, in other words, any person with sufficient intelligence would come to these conclusions. I'm not trying to insult your intelligence by stating these simple things, but at least these are things which we should not overlook. So as we say at the taking the first of the qualities and characteristics of God that we mentioned, that He is eternal and unchanging, what are some of the conclusions that can be drawn from this? Now, I'm not going to go down the line here in the outline. I presume that you can all read. And as I said yesterday, we're not going to look up all these references that we have supplied. These are only some suggestions for your use and guidance. And you can greatly expand upon the number of references that we have here. Because for some of these so-called principles, you can find dozens of references. But we have, as we said also yesterday, we do not claim that this list of principles is exhaustive. There are others that will appeal to you as being obvious. They are more in the way of suggestions, a way of organizing our thinking about our lives and their relationship with God. So, the fact that God is eternal and unchanging is extremely important to us, is it not? Because we have taken upon us the name of the Lord Jesus Christ for a very pragmatic reason. Pragmatic or practical means the same thing. Namely, it is a source of hope, which the apostle to the Hebrews said, we have fled for refuge unto the hope set before us. Now, a hope, if it is to have any practical value, must be dependable. And to make it dependable requires that there be an everlasting or eternal being who can at all times assure and ensure that what we hope for may be fulfilled. But of course, mankind is not fundamentally logical. We are a peculiar makeup, or mix-up, perhaps would be a better way to say it, of the ability to be logical and the ability to be illogical. Maybe you wouldn't think of this as an ability, but nevertheless, we are very successful, we'll put it that way, at being illogical. Because we have built into our makeup a strong component that we generally call emotion, or a scriptural synonym would be passions or lusts. And we're not thinking of these in the basest sense, but desires. In fact, in German, Lust, which L-U-S-T, means desire. And our desires, as we should all well know, so often run contrary to the will and commandments of God. And human beings, because of their intense desires, tend to put their hope and trust in what they can see close about them. For example, it is fairly obvious that the pagans who know that if you things don't grow too well in the shade, that sunlight is necessary for growth, And that if they planted their crops and the sun shone upon them and if they were watered and so forth, they had food. So naturally, they, in their feeble imagination, thought of the sun as a god. And of course, that was the principal god in Egypt, although Egypt, the Egyptians, like the Greeks and Babylonians and others, had almost more gods than Carter has pills. So there is a tendency, and we're all subject to this tendency, to look to those things that are very close to us and to give them our attention and affection. And as we shall see a little bit later on, the fact that God is invisible ministers to this tendency to look toward the things which we can see about us, from which we can feel a practical relationship. And so, as the pagans, we can erect our own gods or idols. Idols don't have to be made out of wood or stone or metal, do they? After all, the object in wood, stone, or metal is the creation of human hands, but the human hands that created these things are directed by the human mind. And as God says through Isaiah, in speaking of the illogicality of human beings, when they have a craftsman to make an idol for them, he may make it out of wood. He uses part of the wood to warm himself, part to cook his food, and says, thou art my God, deliver me. And then says he doesn't stop to think, is there not a lie or a bit of obvious illogicality in what I'm doing? They just don't stop to think about it. But then take ourselves. All of us are keenly aware of the fact that in this age where economics plays such an important part, jobs and having a job is a very important thing. And just like health, we may not appreciate it until we lose it. And so we tend to give to the job or something else the devotion and attention beyond what it really deserves, and thereby deprive God of some of the attention and devotion that we should be giving to Him. I think all of us, if we're honest with ourselves, would admit to the fact that this is at least a temptation, and in many cases, and I would have to, like Tom yesterday, I would have to plead guilty to having been over-concerned with job security and so forth. And this is wrong. Then the fact that there is an eternal God who doesn't change, as he told the children of Israel, the fact that he didn't change was the explanation for why they had not been destroyed, because he has determined that Israel shall not be destroyed. Along with this unchangeability, then, comes the fact that there are unchangeable standards of right and wrong, which can serve as infallible guides. Now, one of the illnesses of the human race today is that it is rejecting the idea that there are infallible, unchanging standards. And so the world wants to reject this idea. It wants to escape from the obligation to obey God, because most intelligent people will realize that if God is, and there is much evidence in that direction, which it is not in our purpose to try to establish in this course of discussions, then as the dependent creature, he has an obligation, a duty to obey the will of the Creator. And so in their, but in their desire to serve their own lusts, which the will of the Creator runs counter to in many ways, they try to make, as they say, everything relative. We've entitled this True Principles in an Unprincipled World. When we say the world is unprincipled, we do not mean that the world does not have its own principles. It does. One of the principles of the world that we find established throughout the whole animal kingdom, for example, is that the old, for a time at least, take care of their young. And as far as the world of civilization, one of the principles that it operates on, as my cousin used to say, the first law of economics, which is charging all that the traffic will bear. This is a principle that the world operates on. But when we say the world is unprincipled, we're referring to it as being unprincipled to a large degree in terms of God's principles. But even in the world, there are some of these true principles which the world, by and large, still observes. For example, one of these principles is honesty, which is, of course, naturally a divine principle. But it is, even the world can recognize that this is a practical principle. Commercial organizations deal, as they say, largely, in good faith. And when a business organization prospers and has always fulfills its word, it acquires what they call a good name. And if the time comes when they decide to sell the business, a substantial amount of money can be demanded for the good name of the organization. And so it is that even the world, in its very selfish and practical ways, gives, let us say, grudging acknowledgement of the true principles of God. Also, it used to be, in the company that I used to work for until they decided my brain wasn't worth anything anymore, if anyone was caught indulging in any form of immorality, he was fired, or she was fired, immediately without any recourse at all. But nowadays, things are different. Things are slipping. The attention and respect for, attention to and respect for moral principles is very rapidly slipping, and so the world is slipping into a very precarious position. Looking at it more nearly toward the Bible, let's just take the attitude of the United States government toward the state of Israel. The United States is the only friend, or maybe we should say partial friend, that the nation of Israel has today. But that friendship is slipping, is it not? For the simple reason that the country is in need of what the Arabs have, and they, as they say, we must look out for our own interests. So looking out for our own interests is a worldly principle. And so, as I fully expect, Israel will be totally abandoned in the near future by all of its so-called worldly friends. Now, I think it might be worth your time for me to read just a little bit of the introduction that Brother Collier has in this book, because it illustrates it so clearly. It's in the first chapter entitled Guidance in Life. He says, if a man is well equipped with a knowledge of principles, he is in a favorable position for dealing with all the difficulties of life. He may find himself confronted by entirely new circumstances. There may be nothing in empirically gained knowledge to throw the slightest light on his path. But he can nearly always find a principle to help his judgment. Principles are like stars, constant and comprehensive, but not local or particular. The pilot with only local knowledge may guide the ship through the well-known channel and into the old port. But a knowledge of the stars is necessary when sailing in the unknown seas. This, of course, was written in the days before they had the types of navigational control that is now used in missiles and things like that. If a pilot should mistake a foreign port for the one he knows and attempt to guide the vessel according to the old rules, he will bring it to disaster. Ships of various kinds have been wrecked through such mistaken confidence. Oftentimes men have ignored principles and have applied the lessons learned in former years to circumstances that are totally different. They have even quoted the words of former leaders in a manner that would horrify such leaders could they rise from their graves and witness the application. And this, of course, is part of our problem, is it not? This world that we are living in is changing in many ways. So therefore, we need to use the illustration that he gives here to have a knowledge of the stars and be guided by them. Very interesting thing that those of you who take the Geographic magazine, the current issue is on partly on bird migration, showing how the birds migrate by the stars. And they have proved this by putting birds in cages in planetaria where they project on the dome of the planetarium the constellations, and the bird will flutter in the cage and orient itself according to the stars. Of course, the birds had very wise parents to teach them how to do this. So, we need to have respect to these unvarying standards of right. And this presents problems for our young people, does it not? Because when we are young, we tend to orient our thinking according to our peers, what we see others doing. And every mother, I'm sure, has had her teenager say, but this is what they are doing. Even though the things that their peers may be doing may lead to disastrous consequences in their lives. And so it becomes a problem. How do we cope with these changing times, to borrow a commercial term? We can only do it by knowing what the unvarying standards of right and wrong are, and to help our children by trying to convince them that there are such unvarying standards and that the varying so-called standards of the world are not true standards. But it's no easy job, as I say, any parent with teenagers can testify. But it is all important. There used to be a prominent brother, and there are still several brethren of more or less prominence who used to say that it is absolutely wrong for a Christadelphian to send his children to college. Because it's a well-known fact, of course, that many young people do go astray when they go to college. Well, why do they go astray when they go to college? It's because they were not properly equipped before they went to college with a sound set of guiding principles as to what is truly right and what is wrong. And so it's a cop-out, we might say, for the parents to blame the college for ruining their kids. The kids might have gone there in a state to be ruined. Well, we just toss this out. I realize that this is not going to sit too well, perhaps, with some of you. I would say, for example, not in defense of going to college, but I think I can say very honestly that what success God has granted to me in teaching the truth to people has been greatly enhanced by some of the skills that I acquired in college. So, education is just like any tool. A hammer, for example, can be used to drive nails to build a house, but it can also be used to smash somebody else's skull. Is it the hammer's fault? Obviously not. It's only a tool, and it is the use to which tools are put. And science is another example. Science, after all, is only the discovery of the principles of the universe that God has established. I'm speaking of science now in this basic sense. But the applications that men make of science can be either very good and beneficial for humanity, or they can be very evil. And so here then is where the human mind enters with its objectives and directives. This is what then makes the difference between whether scientific knowledge is good or whether it is evil. And as I said earlier, human nature is a grand mix-up of good and evil, though fundamentally perhaps more evil than good. And so it is when the human element enters that things go in the wrong direction, or the right direction, as the case may be. Along then with this fact, the next fact we mention, God's power is infinite. We mentioned yesterday that in leaving the typewriter one time and then coming back to it another time, we left out some things. You notice I have under B principles in the plural, and then I have only one. And these are the ones that I had inadvertently omitted, and I put them up on the board here so that if you want to copy them onto the borders of your outline sheets, you may do so. Some of you with bad perspective here from where you sit may not be able to read this at all, but after we discuss this first one, we'll turn to the others. And again, this is belaboring the obvious. The only thing is, it is not obvious to all people. Namely, it is folly to ignore or to oppose God. Does this require any justification? If indeed we believe in God, we hardly think it does not. We have some references here that bear on it. So we won't dwell on too much on these very obvious things. And then the second one, for the benefit of those in the wings here, the power which created all things may do for us or against us what is beyond our power to influence. Now, we have an excellent example of this principle being put into operation in the Scriptures. And where can we find this spelled out in great detail? Now, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. I won't shame you for not knowing the answer, but I would suggest you read Leviticus 26 or Deuteronomy 28. And what do those chapters contain? Charlie? Yes. If the nation, and this was given to them in the wilderness, would obey God's laws and keep his covenant and so forth, he would do thus and thus and thus and thus and thus for them. He would make them the principal nation on earth, and all their enemies would be powerless before them. But if they would not keep his commandments and their soul abhorred his ordinances, he would do thus and thus and thus and thus. And what has history borne out? Exactly the latter, has it not? And they have been suffering for millennia for their sins. And so this is indeed a true principle. They have tried to influence this in various ways, and they have been unable to. And it will be only when God chooses to cast all their sins into the depth of the sea, when the final, at the end of the final jubilee and proclamation of liberty throughout the land, when every man returns unto his own possession, then and only then will those who are accounted worthy to be there enjoy these great blessings. So nationally, they are a showcase example of the folly of opposing God and of their inability to influence advantageously the power of God exerted upon them. And so the third one is, again, belaboring the obvious, our only hope of good, which includes life, health, and certainly our eternal welfare, is to seek the favor of him who has limitless power. Again, this hardly needs justification, does it? And though I could supply you with some references here, I think it would be a healthy exercise for you to supply your own. So let's go on to try to make progress. We're following the outline, but not slavishly, I hope. Now, I said yesterday at the beginning, I want this to be your class, if we may call such a class, not mine. I entertain the fact that I relish serious questions on any of these points. I tolerate disagreement, and if anyone wants to disagree, he's perfectly welcome to do so. Of course, where things are so intensely obvious, it's a little embarrassing to disagree, is it not? All right, but remember that invitation is open all through the week, so I like feedback. Of course, as an old prop, I can get feedback through eye contact and other things. I once had a mathematics professor who, in going over the problems that were to be worked for the day, he said, "Now, problem number three, let me see. Oh, Mr. So-and-so, will you put it on the board?" Well, Mr. So-and-so couldn't work the problem. One wondered how he could tell, but he sure was able to tell. This is a skill you acquire with experience. All right, God's knowledge, understanding, and wisdom are infinite. The scriptures abundantly testify to this, do they not? But there are some obvious conclusions to this which we sometimes overlook. Namely, are we ever tempted to think that we can do something in secret and get away with it? I think if we have are thoroughly honest with ourselves, we can say that, foolish as this may be, we are at times tempted to think we can. And Solomon says, because that sentence against an evil work is not speedily executed, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. In other words, we don't get our comeuppance immediately. It's this delay between the act and the punishment, let us say, our being informed that this, our act has been observed, encourages us to do evil. And we have a showcase example of this in the scriptures. Anyone any idea what I'm thinking about? Tom.
David,
precisely. Exactly. How long was it after David committed adultery with Bathsheba that God lowered the boom on him? Yes. The child was born, was it not? And so the sentence against the evil work was long delayed. And in the meantime, David had time to accrue interest on his sin, did he not? But of course, David was man enough to say, I have sinned. He wasn't like Saul, who was so concerned with the welfare of Mrs. Kish's little boy that he could only think in terms of justifying himself, as he tried to do before Samuel, who wanted him to justify him before the people after he had committed a great trespass. Also, it is interesting to say, and this undoubtedly gives people some difficulty. He says to God in the 51st Psalm, against thee, thee only have I sinned and done all this evil. Didn't he sin against Uriah? You bet he did. Then why does it say against thee, thee only have I sinned and done all this evil? Alright, well, all infractions of God's law are sins against Him, are they not? Human beings may be involved in it, alright, but the basic sin is against God. And as we get, hopefully later on, into our consideration of ecclesial things, I just pose this because of its connection here. Suppose somebody in our ecclesia commits a serious sin. Don't we hear people say we should forgive him? Is it our place to forgive sins of this kind? It's again, the sin is against God. And God and Christ only can forgive sins. We can't. Surely, we may try to recover as much as we can for the person spiritually and his eternal welfare. But to forgive such sin is not ours to do. And it is presumption. And Brother Carlson read from the 19th Psalm this morning, keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sins and let them not have dominion over me. Yes, we must be merciful, but we must not presume to usurp God's exercise of mercy. Well, that's just a point in connection with it. And so, as we say, God knows our characters accurately. In fact, the psalmist says that he knows the psalmist's thought even before the psalmist has that thought. He can look into the future. He knows what we
will or what we shall think in the future. So therefore, it should behoove us, I would think, to plot our course very carefully with a full knowledge and appreciation that our course has, in the sense, been discerned. I realize we're treading on psychologically difficult ground here because we have the eternal problem of the trying to resolve the apparent conflict between God's foreknowledge and free will. We won't try to get into that right now. So again, belaboring the obvious, as we say, God's knowledge of just what we are should motivate us to obey Him just as carefully as we would were we able to behold Him watching our every move. When we were boys in school, or girls in school too, we might have passed notes to one another, or done other things, as we would say, behind the teacher's back, or maybe behind the back of the student sitting right in front of us, in a hope that we would not be observed, and we may have gotten away with it for a time, but such attempts with to get away with things from God's knowledge is sheer folly. And the important thing which we should all realize is this. God deals with us primarily, and His opinion of us is based upon what we are. What we are. Now, of course, human beings can only judge by the sight of their eyes and their hearing of their ears. We may think that we may judge somebody else's motives and thoughts, and we may have a very good inkling as to what somebody else's thoughts are or what his motives are for doing what he is doing, but we can never prove it. That isn't the case, of course, with God's knowledge. He requires no witness from anybody else. So therefore, we should always walk with the idea that we, our every act, our every word, our every thought is being monitored. You know, a few years ago, people were sort of facetiously commenting upon the Soviet states interfering in the lives of people, and you remember the saying, Big Brother is watching you. And of course, people resent this, although they, in such totalitarian states, can't do anything about it. And the surveillance of their acts is a serious matter, because an inadvertent statement can land one in Siberia. It's an evil situation. But there's nothing evil about God's surveillance of us. In fact, though it has implications that may give us pause, and certainly should, it is also a superb blessing. Other people, even brethren, may accuse us of wrongdoing, wrong thinking, wrong doctrine, and so forth. But no one can falsely accuse us to God or to Christ, His appointed judge, because they know us for what we are. So therefore, if our conscience is clear, if we are doing truth, and that is a scriptural term, we walk in the light as he is in the light and so forth, and John speaks of doing truth or not doing the truth, which I'm not trying to usurp your territory here, Tom, but in order to do truth, we must first be truth. And so as Jesus said, as you can read in the third chapter of John's Gospel, that men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. But whosoever does righteousness or whosoever is true comes to the light that his deeds may be manifest. So therefore, as I say, if we have clear consciences, free of offense, as Paul was able to say before the Sanhedrin, then we know that there is no misunderstanding of our quality and worth in God's sight. Okay, time is up.